Can they really free us from our karmic hindrances? With a heart of total devotion to all the Buddhas, sincerely acknowledging our ancient twisted karma, with a wholehearted wish to be free so we can meet this world clearly and openly, then the Buddhas can free us from these karmic effects. And if doubt arises, then we vow to be free from this doubt. Upon meeting the true Dharma, no doubt will arise in us. If today is Rohatsu, being celebrated by various Zen people in the Saha world in which we live, may the auspicious blessings of Shakyamuni Buddha's great enlightenment radiate upon us and all beings today, supporting us in our sesshin. This issue of the view of the independent self, the inherently existent self, the self that seems to exist from its own side, the self that seems to reside as the owner, the controller, the judge of body and mind, that seems to have been here permanently from the day we were born to this moment, that seems to be not just a mentally created illusion born of mind, but seems to be like the owner of mind. The owner of mind cannot be born from mind. That would be absurd. Is there really like an owner of this mind? Of my mind? We speak as if there is, you know, when we say, my mind is like this today, my body feels like this, implies that it belongs to me. And the more I sit with this, investigating this view, the more I'm convinced, maybe I should say, you know, I've been convinced quite clearly of this before, but the more I'm reminded again and again how this still seems to be the case, that this view the sense of the independent self, that there's somebody, the controller, the owner, the assessor of my experience, That one, I propose, is the linchpin of samsara and the cycle of suffering of all problems. Dukkha, may often translate as suffering, but we could call it discontent, dissatisfaction. Even when things are going well, it's not quite exactly right. It's not complete joy and ease. This is dukkha, big or little, comes and goes. And I've heard that the etymology of dukkha is like a wheel out of whack, like maybe it's not quite round, or maybe the axle hole is kind of loose, so it's wobbly. And when we roll along through our life on such a wobbly wheel, it's not a smooth ride. Something like this is the etymology of dukkha. So if it's dukkha is like a wobbly wheel, the linchpin, which I've heard is like the pin that goes through an axle that holds the wheel on. The linchpin that holds the wobbly wheel going like this, where it will not stop. The linchpin is this imagination, unconscious or conscious, that there's some owner of our experience. The linchpin, so if that one is carefully slid out, then this wobbly wheel can, axle arrangement, the whole thing can just fall apart, and the wobbly ride can stop. We might wonder, well then, how can we get anywhere? What to do? But that very wonder is all wrapped around the linchpin. The linchpin is also like, you know, the essential ingredient that makes something work. We call it a view of the independent self, but it's not like some intellectually constructed view. It's much deeper. It's like we don't have to make any effort to hold this view. It comes with the package of birth as a human. How to talk about this? You know, the Buddha talks about this over and over. Sometimes I feel it's even Buddha's central message, even though it's a small part of the sutras and so on. I feel, at least today, that it's the linchpin teaching. And it can be put in many ways, as I mentioned the other day. But here's one sutra where the Buddha says, I do not envision grasping to any view of the self where there would not arise sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. It's like, if there's any grasping or holding, consciously or unconsciously, usually it's unconsciously holding the sense of me-ness, of a me apart from my body and mind, this body and mind experience. I cannot imagine that there could be holding such a view without sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. In other words, this is the root of dukkha. And then Buddha says, "What do you think, monks? If a person were to gather or burn or do as he likes with the grass, twigs, branches, and leaves here in this park, would the thought occur to you, it's us that this person is gathering, burning, and doing with as he likes?" It's kind of a ridiculous question. So when you're raking the pile of leaves at, in the quiet grove, mountain, garden, we look at the leaves and say, "These leaves are like me, like careful with them." We don't really think that way, right? So the monks say, "No, Lord. Why is that?" "Because those things, those leaves and twigs that are being raked up and burned, they're not ourself and they don't belong to ourself. Those leaves are not me and they're not mine." Obviously they're not me in this straightforward way. We might say, "Well, what if it is, like, if it's like, you know, the leaves in my yard that I was trying to gather and press in to make leaf decorations or something, and like, oh, don't burn those." Then we might actually feel like they're mine. They belong to a self, and it might bother us to burn them. But for the most leaves are like, you know, they're not me and they're not mine, so it doesn't bother me so much what happens to them. And then the Buddha says, "Even so, just like this, monks, whatever isn't yours, let go of it. Your letting go of it will be for your long-term welfare and happiness. And what isn't yours, besides the pile of leaves? Form, feeling, perceptions, formations, consciousness, the five aggregates, body and mind, are not yours. Therefore, let go of them. Your letting go of them will be for your long-term welfare and happiness." I think that story, you can contemplate it. I think it kind of points out a little bit. It's, you know, this is a difficult thing to talk about. What is this sense of self, this linchpin? But if it's the owner of like a pile of leaves, then we start having all kinds of major concerns about what happens to the leaves. And if it's the owner of body and mind, we have major concerns about what's going on with its body and mind. We try to control it, judge it, think it's not good enough, stop the thoughts, change the feelings, alter the body, all these things. If we feel like they are mine, they are me or mine. So Buddha says, just let go of these things that aren't yours, body and mind, the five aggregates of all our experiences. Let them be as they are. I think it's a good practice. But in Dokusan the other day, I think I maybe mentioned this before, something like let go of this sense of self. So someone in Dokusan said, "Well, how do you let go of this self? You know, it just keeps, here it is. I feel this sense of me. I'm like kind of holding it as, you know, in Sashin we get very intimate with this sense of me, right? That's having the problem. How can I just let go of it? It just keeps coming back." And I thought, that is like the greatest question. That was a a wonderful thing to bring up. And I feel like that's when we start investigating this kind of thing. It really deeply in our own experience, that's the kind of question that comes up. If we just, oh yeah, just let go of it. Yeah, I know, I've heard that many times. Okay, just try to let go of it. Okay. No, you actually really focus on what is that to let go of this. And then you see, how can I just let go of it? So that's a question that comes from trying to take up this practice of dropping off body and mind. And the Buddha says here to let go of it. But when I thought about that in that Dokusan, I thought, well, maybe it's right. We can't really just decide to just let go of it. It's more like we investigate it deeply. We take like more than just a look, deeply investigate what is this sense of me. Get really familiar with it. So much that we see what it is, that we see that actually it's a mind-created illusion. There's not really an owner here. And we might have heard this kind of thing a lot, so we might, without investigating it deeply, might say, yeah, I know, yeah, anatman, yeah, no self. I've heard it many times. Yeah, there's no owner here, there's just the experience. But then, but what about like my knee and my knee? And what about like, you know, my problems that I have to deal with after this sesshin? And we're right back into it. It's fueling our samsara. So it's not, we can't just hear this kind of thing and just say, oh yeah, sounds good. We have to investigate, and even if we've investigated to the very bottom and seen through it, it comes back. It's so, we've had this view for like, you know, billions of lifetimes, according to the story. So it's not like you could just let go of it, or you can see it once and then it never comes back. That would be nice, wouldn't it? And maybe occasionally it is like that. I think for the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, it maybe was like that. I think because he'd been primed in his bodhisattva practice for so many lifetimes up to this point, with calm abiding and investigating mind and deep practice, stability and devotion, that when that insight struck him to the marrow, the illusion never arose again. Yes?
I just wanted to ask you, and as well, does this sound to you like addiction?
Addiction?
Addiction.
Addiction to the view of self?
Like an addiction problem, you
know? Yeah.
Of cigarette smoking or some other type of health behavior that
it's the root addiction. Yes, I think so.
And you can have an insight of, wow, smoking is really
yeah.
Not just all the labels and everything, but you feel it.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe a relative dies and I've seen what I'm saying. Maybe that's enough, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're just quite cold turkey, but then there's sort of this withdrawal that happens.
Yes. That's a great analogy. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think you could treat it like an addiction, and you know, where you're aware of all the cravings for grasping as self comes up, and you can just say, "Oh, you know, not now." And as much as possible, you don't, you know, jump right back into it. And see if you can't be a little more distant from it. I mean, that's
yeah.
You can
So in the addiction metaphor too, we might say, there's all kinds of skillful practices we can do when we still have the addiction to basically like avoid the substance we're addicted to, for example. So like, I don't know if how maybe it works. If we're addicted to the view of the self, it's not like you can actually avoid that. It's in our face all the time. But we cannot act on it. Maybe that would be it. Avoid, you know, the substance is there in front of us all the time, but we cannot take it, which would be like, I really want to like kill somebody or myself. I'm like, no, it's just not, okay? I still have the addiction and I really want to, but let's just refrain. And that's, we could say the precepts is like when we're addicted to the view of self, the bodhisattva precepts are a good practice to just don't do it, don't act on these, on this actions that come from the view of the independent self. But it doesn't really, all these practices we're doing in Sashin about staying with it and so on are all really great, but they won't really cure the addiction, I propose. They're just the skillful ways to avoid falling into the situation. Yes?
It hadn't occurred to me before, but we investigate the self to know the self and then to let go of the self. And it seems to me that, in my experience, that I'm trying to get to know myself through how I observe precepts, how my behavior plays out, and then I start finding how can I drop the I in my movement in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that it's a big deal. That as you behave however you behave, that you keep watching this, and the eye is so much there, even though you're trying to do good deeds, you're trying to model your behavior in a way that you think is appropriate, and the eye is so prevalent, and there's the problem of.
Yeah. And sometimes it's just, you know, being completely immersed in some activity, the eye often is not so active. So a lot of Zen practices, you just do it, we say. Just completely, wholeheartedly do whatever we're doing.
Yeah, I was thinking about how Colvin used to talk about shikantaza being very slippery. And you keep falling off it.
Yeah.
Really doing shikantaza, then the self, you're not aware of the self, but then, you know, in an instant.
Yeah, that's how we fall off it, right?
That's when you fall off it.
The self pulls us off it,
yeah.
You could say. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I suspect this realization of the small self not being real has something to do with realizing a greater force working through you and mm-hmm. directing all your activities mm-hmm. and your thinking.
That's another way to put it, yeah. And you could say, we might even say, well, in these early teachings, you say, well, then how is all this happening if there's nobody at the helm, at the steering wheel? Well, it's dependent co-arising of the five aggregates is how it happens. Perfectly, a person and a world is created and works all together just due to causes and conditions. And then later, the teaching came in of, well, it seems like more than that. And that's when people said, let's call it Buddha nature. You know, it's, which is like not the self, but it's kind of awakened awareness working, you know, manifesting as a person. And even awakened awareness manifesting as this illusion of an independent self. That's the amazing thing. That awakened mind can manifest as this linchpin illusion just for fun. It's here, you know, why would it do that, right? Well, just so we can have sashin. And there can be Buddhas can appear in the world, you know. If it didn't manifest like that, there'd be no use for Buddhas appearing in the world. It would just be like freedom and brightness. So it makes things interesting for sure. But yeah, I think that's another part is why it's hard to look at, to see this view and think, well, how can all this, how can this body of mind keep going without the self here? So we say, well, it does. There are five skandhas work fine without the self. The Buddha proved it. You know, like that illusion was no longer operating, but five skandhas still could function in the world, and not just like barely function much better, you know, much more freely, happily, and compassionately. So, as Chuck was saying, you know, it's like we in our daily activities, we can see how the me comes up, and we say, oh, this is extra, let's just go back to the activity and do it. In Sashin in particular, I think, and in Zazen, particularly like lots of Zazen like this, we get a chance to do this really like very still, calm, investigative practice of like, here it is now. I get this, I have the sense in me. You can, if you're having trouble locating it, if there's any discontent going on, then there it's there. If you're really, really totally at ease and peace, then maybe it's actually temporarily like not active, and wait, you can wait a little while and it'll come back soon enough. Guaranteed. And then when it's there, then you can say, oh, okay, I'm suffering now. And then you ask, well, who's suffering? Yeah, there's me. And the more we're suffering, the more solid, I think, is the sense of the I. And then we can start to investigate, like, what is this? And it's quite hard to do because it's also very slippery, just like Shikantaza. It's not something like, oh, it's this little, like, it's this little jewel at the center called me that's like, with all these little radio signals going out to the rest of the, it's, you know, we can't like pin it down. It's because it's an illusion. It has no location. And if you try to pin it down, somewhere in your experience, it slips to another part of your experience, which just keeps showing us again and again how it's like this, it's a mind-made thing. So the more you can see that, oh, this sense of the me, we could, like the wounded me, or the sorry for myself me, or the inflated me, or the depressed me, as like, well, there can be like, you know, a painful situation, but that, see if I can get a sense for that owner of it. And then see, is there really an owner of it? And then we see that actually doesn't really seem to be one. It does at first, but then it slips away. And so then, it's no longer so much a matter of letting go of it. Okay, just let go of this. When you actually see how it's a mind construction, we don't even have to let go of it. It's like, it's enough to just see what it is. And it, maybe you could say it drops away, but maybe you say it doesn't even, it's still there, but we've seen through it. Like it's no longer fooling us, right? Yeah, me, you little like, you know, the little Kokyo at the center there that's calling the shots. Yeah, you can go ahead, keep doing it. It's no problem to me because I see it's just a little game that the mind is playing here. You're not really like, I'm not giving you the credit that you want. as the controller. And that's what we could call letting go of it. You know, it might even still be like doing its thing, but we're not fueling with like trying to do something about it. So when Dogen says to study the Buddha way is to study the self, to investigate the self, to understand the self, to study the self and understand the self is to forget the self. It, you know, or forget is like let go, right? So to really understand it, to study it, investigate, and understand it is to let go of it. It might even still be appearing here.
Is it kind of like, let's say you have a thought of that, you know, that you didn't like something
that's
happening,
yeah.
And you say, yeah, I really can't stand it.
Yeah, I can't stand it.
But yeah. I see that I can't stand it. And so it's like putting something between the thought and your attachment to it.
Yeah.
You just see that it
doesn't. Yeah, it's a thought. Or alternatively, you could ask, who can't stand it?
Uh-huh.
You know? Well, I can't stand it. Like the I, the more we really can't stand something, the I gets bigger and bigger. I can't stand it. Well, who can't? You can say, well, this body and mind can't stand it. And then it's already, that lightens the load a lot. You know, like, this body and mind and my karmic tendencies that, you know, prefer these things and not these things, that whole package can't stand it. Well, that's okay, because that's just a conditioned package. But I can't say it, that's the problem.
So. There's some recent studies, scientific studies, tie in to this talk somehow. And what it is they were given a series of questions and something like that, and they were picking up the answers 1 second or more before the actual person would give.
Oh, yeah.
So the physiology or the universal physiology was responding beyond the conscious awareness of the person.
Mm-hmm.
So they were picking up the answers before the person consciously became aware of that.
Yeah.
So there's stuff going on, I mean, outside our conscious awareness.
Yeah, well, that's another good example of how without the sense of self, still, there's a highly complex, amazing, dependently co-arising universe of sentient beings that are all completely interconnected in inconceivable ways beyond our wildest dreams. That's going on. But it's hard to appreciate that when it's like, I can't stand this. You know? I can't stand some little part of this amazing flow of universal harmony. There's this flow of universal harmony, but like, I can't stand that like somebody dropped a candy wrapper on the ground. Whatever. the I can't stand it. But also, you know, when investigating this, it's interesting to look at it seems like we can still have all kinds of preferences and likes and dislikes. That's part of our conditioning. And all that can be part of the five skanda event. But so I don't think that when the sense of the I, of the independent I, is seen through, that there's no more preferences. It doesn't seem to work that way. I think there's still preferences. It's just that the whole thing's loosened up. Exactly. Yeah.
Like it.
Yep.
You don't get it.
Yeah, like that. Yeah, we might even be somewhat attached just because we've had preferences for countless eons. But even the attachment is kind of loosened up. It's like, when we're seeing clearly, I really, really, really want this and not this. If we're in touch with the seeing through the view of the eye that wants it, it's like, oh, that's interesting. There's a strong desire here. But I can see it's just, it's a conditioned it's this conditioned thing, and it's not, even then it's not such a problem. Even it, it's no big deal. Or maybe, you know, a medium-sized deal, even sometimes. But it's not as big as it was when it's like, I have. So we might even, I think there's somewhere even in the sutras that the Buddha doesn't maybe talk about percentages like this, but it may be a commentary or something like, seeing through this view is like, eliminates like 95% of suffering. And then the other 5% to actually be like a full Buddha is really hard work. That's like basically undoing all these habit patterns and stuff. But and I've contemplated this. This is kind of like these stages of enlightenment, you know, in the foundational teachings. You know, at this first stage, it's like you've cut through like almost all problems. So you say, why? And the rest is going to be much more difficult. Why bother with the other 5%? or another way it's sometimes said was, sometimes in the Mahayana it's put like, you can see through the illusion, not just of the self, but of the self inherent existence of all phenomena, but they still keep appearing. Like, and then it said for Buddhas, even the appearances drop away. And I once pushed my teacher about this, who I think is really upholds the Mahayana teachings of going all the way like this. And, you know, if basically you're not really suffering anymore. It's because if you see appearances as appearances, then why do you have to eliminate the appearances? And it seems like that's such a, like a, you know, it's such a big trouble. It seems to take such a long time, and it's not such a problem. And I think he said something like, well, it's just if you want to complete this whole path the way that it's laid out, you know, if you want to do the Buddha thing as it's presented, then just for the sake of doing that, then you can do it. But yeah, you don't really have to. You can be free. Maybe we say 95% free, but, and this is why, you know, maybe we call it stream and entry in the early teachings, and that's why many of the Buddha's disciples would reach this point of entering the stream, but it's not the full, there's still some more steps, but not so many people took the next steps. And you know, when I contemplate, I can see why. Because it's so great just to get to that point, then you know, there's these plateaus in practice, so we can Sashin's a nice time to challenge ourselves to not be complacent, and you know, to reach this point where we really can see through the illusion in a kind of sustainable way is quite an undertaking, right? So I think this is something we can work on for a long, long time too. Even if we see through it once and like, oh, I'm sitting here in this ball of like pain and problems, but it's like there's an almost ecstatic ease at the source of it when we're not like, when there's no owner of the whole thing. Or like, was it Dongshan, our Zen ancestor, said something when his teacher said, are you joyful? He said, it's not that I'm not joyful. It's like finding a jewel in a pile of shit. So I think this is like, and you could say the other 5% would be like, you know, completely washing away the whole rest of the pile of shit, so you just have the shining jewel. But you could say, the pile of shit's kind of nice, or it's like not even nice or not nice when there's the perfectly free jewel right in the middle of it. It's like, you could kind of take it or leave it. but that jewel, which is not some special fancy, like, mysterious thing, right? It's just that jewel is just not reifying, believing in the owner of the pile. Whose pile of shit is this anyway?
To see through an illusion requires awareness.
Deep awareness. Yeah. Deep awareness.
So you can't solve the problem until you develop
this
Buddha awareness. It might be that the Buddha is the only reality there is, and everything else is an illusion, including our own small ego.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the I is the Buddha. I don't know. But I'm just
Well, there's different ways of talking about, you know, the I. So this one is, you know, the illusion of the owner or creator and experiencer. You could say it's a manifestation. Ultimately, we have to say it's a manifestation of Buddha nature, because what wouldn't be? And yet, but we can't really equate it with, like, that's like the Buddha. That's like more like the linchpin of samsara that we carefully pull out. But your point about we have to have a deep awareness to investigate and see through this is very true, which I think is why Sasheen. It's why, personally, I love Sasheen so much. It's because of this. Because it's the only chance, in my experience, in this body and mind experience, yeah, not the only, but it's the main opportunity I find to, like, you know, have this much time and space and no other particular distractions, not many, to really look at this again and again and see this. Because in daily life, even daily zazen, it's like, it's easy to just get caught up in, okay, with the 40 minutes, we're just maybe like just settling down from the stress of yesterday and preparing for the stress of today. So, yeah. Sasheen is just an amazing opportunity to, we might not even feel like, well, I'm not that concentrated. We might feel like, I feel like I'm not getting that concentrated in Sasheen. I'm not really staying with my breath that much. But in my experience, we may feel that way. And at the same time, I think there is, despite ourselves, you're just sitting this much, there's some underlying sensitivity. We feel a little different, don't we? Even if we're like, feel like, ah, I'm still getting distracted, thinking about the past and future a lot. Still, I think the mind is getting more flexible and permeable, and it can easily turn. Sometimes I feel like in quite a distracted period in Sasheen, I'm really like just spinning out some story here, but then I'll remember like, oh yeah, let's come back to Sasheen now. And just decide. Sometimes within like a few seconds, it's like, you know, the whole story is just gone. And daily zazen, you can try doing that, and it's kind of like, no, we got to work this one out. We got to spin it a few more periods. Sometimes sasheen's like that too, but I think maybe you have that experience. The mind gets a little bit more like, it's more playful. It's more like, oh, really? Just like, how can we? I can't stand it. We might even be like, oh, never mind. Sometimes it can be like that, you know. Any other questions about this issue of self, like what we're talking about with this self that we're looking for, how it's being made by the mind? Well, then let's hear some from Kodo Sawaki, Roshi's story. This is just, you know, is this a toy to hear this story? Or is it, you know, I think it can be inspiration for somebody who's just totally devoted to zazen, like us. You people are astounding. I can't believe you just are willing to sit here. for this long. We could just be, you know, go for a walk or something. It's amazing, you know. And even of all the Dharma practitioners in Santa Cruz, I'm sure hundreds, if not thousands, only this little handful sitting Rohatsu, Sesshin. It's not easy. It's great devotion. Even you might feel, I don't even know what I'm doing. I'm not very devoted. Believe me, you're devoted. Not many people in this world, not even many Dharma practitioners, will sit in a room for even a day. It's amazing. But just so we don't get too proud of this, here's some story from Kodo Sawaki.
Do we still have all 10 fingers?
Sawaki's studies at Horyuji in Nara when he was studying Yogacara. I love that this, you know, no-nonsense Zazen guy who's like never even quotes the sutras or anything did all this, you know, mind-only study, because I'm a big fan of this mind-only study. It's highly conceptual, you know, explanations of how the mind creates illusion, basically, is what it's all about. But it's just a very advanced, leaving no loose ends description of how this works. We don't need to really know how it works, but for doubting types like me, that's like, well, what do you mean the self is constructed by mind? Well, Asanga and Vasubandhu will explain how this works in 1,000 pages or more. So Kodo Sawaki was into this for a while. It says these studies gave him a solid background for immersing himself in his characteristic way in the works of Dogen. He was aided on this path by his relationship with the renowned Soto monk and Dogen scholar Sotan Oka Roshi. Sotan Oka was one of these great Dogen scholar practitioners of that time, who was also the teacher of Nishiari Bokusan, whose Genjo Koan commentary we're reading, and Kodo Sawaki, and all these different streams. Also, I think Harada Roshi at Hoshinji. And one of the abbots of Antaiji, at least in name. Sawaki talked about learning the fine points of Soto practice, such as the proper way to practice Kinhin, walking meditation from Sotan, but it was the power and authority that his teacher's words and deeds conveyed that left the deepest mark on Sawaki. One incident in particular stood out in his mind. Sawaki was sitting near the Dokusan room during Sesshin, where he could hear the Dokusan interview between Sotan and a monk through the door. Well, what do you want? Sotan's voice had such power, Sawaki said, that the monk's voice was reduced to a whisper. I want to understand the great matter, please, said the monk. Whose great matter? Was the teacher's brusque response. Same point, right? Whose great matter? I want to understand the great matter. Whose great matter? Or who wants to understand this great matter? Whose great matter? Mine? The monk says. What? Yours? If it's just you alone, what does it matter? Sotan responded with a laugh that penetrated to the pit of Sawaki's stomach, though he wasn't even in the room. Your great matter? If it's just your great matter, then what does it matter? That's a nice koan exchange. Around this time, Suwaki, he was 33 years old now, and he was the assistant head of training at this other temple. And he met his friend Kozan Kato. Both were looking for a place where they could practice Zen in a rigorous and serious manner, and were unhappy with the lack of seriousness at Yosenji. After looking for a place to continue his practice and meeting one dead end after another, Sawaki finally turned to his former teacher at Horyuji, Jōin Saiki. And Saiki was nominally in charge of this small temple in Nara. And so nobody was living there. So he said, Sawaki, you can stay there in this little temple in Nara, Jōfukuji. When Suwaki moved in, nobody seemed to be interested in that temple or its goings-on. Nobody even came there. It was like maybe kind of abandoned. Suwaki saw it as a perfect opportunity to close the doors and practice uninterrupted zazen alone. Now he says in his own words, "This temple was completely veiled from society. In the 3 years I was there, no one came to visit, which was most suitable to me. I decided to devote myself completely to zazen, even if I died in the process. Feeling no need to make contact with the world, I closed the gate and sat day after day from 2 a.m. till 10 p.m. My uninterrupted sesshin had begun. 3 years. Does he exaggerate? I don't know. But that's what he says, right? Days passed and nobody came to visit. I sat alone, living like this, continuously for 3 years. As I practiced in this manner, the days and months felt long. People may think that when you practice alone, doing zazen all the time, everything will just go blank. But it doesn't. The more you're alone, the more you eliminate things to do and simplify your life, the more things float to the surface like a crab blowing bubbles. You know, on the beach when you see those little bubbles come up.
Oh, when you open the top of a Coke bottle, the bubbles come up.
Yeah, like that.
And so the things, the pressures, stresses, negativity come up in the nervous system,
yeah.
And your conscious awareness.
Have you noticed this in Sesshin? All our ancient twisted karma starts to come up and reveal itself to us.
Does it say how he fed himself there?
No. It doesn't. But in Japan, it's not so hard to put on the straw sandals and the big bamboo hat and go out with your bowl. Around pretty much any town and collect enough to eat and maybe even pay the rent, even in modern times. And this good practice goes back to the Buddha's time. Just, you know, very unobtrusively just receiving what's offered, and people love to give because that's a fundamental Dharma practice. So for people like this, there are always people to support them if they want to sit. Dogen says, don't worry about, you know, your sustenance. And if you're practicing wholeheartedly, everything will take care of itself. And I feel this is true. Hearing about him here reminds me a little bit of my time living at No Abode Hermitage, where we didn't quite practice quite like that. Although we did have a 7-day sesshin every month for over 3 years. And in between, we kept a kind of like half-day sitting schedule. So it was a lot of zazen, and there wasn't really much to do there, and there were a few of us, which is quite different than being totally alone.
No abode, where is it?
No abode, up in Mill Valley.
Mill Valley?
North of San Francisco. And there too, we didn't have any income. Hardly anyone ever came. So we collected our food in town like that, in the traditional way, which you could say in America, this, you know, people don't understand this, but it worked in Mill Valley. People.
You mean dumpster diving?
No, like just with our bowls, we'd walk on the street and people would give food and just so we could sustain this practice in that kind of way. So Kodo Suwaki Roshi's story is very dear to my heart. You know, when I was there alone in Obode, which was really just a few months, and I would visit Green Gulch Farm sometimes down the road, like the temple where there were other friends. So it wasn't that lonely, but even after a few months there like that, it was like, it could start to get a little like, you need some reality checks. So, I don't know how Kodo Suwaki, if he really didn't see anybody for 3 years, I mean, we don't know the details, right? While I was studying at Horyuji, a friend often said to me, Suwaki, you're always talking zazen, 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 but you won't find people today who will listen to that kind of talk. You're going to pass your life in misery. You won't even find one person who will follow you, and you're going to live a lonely life. Let me tell you something that it wouldn't hurt you to know. You'd be better off learning English. I don't know why, learning English. Maybe you can help somebody like that.
You'd be better off going to law school.
Going to law school. Or go be a fishmonger with your cousin. His prediction actually was right on target with regard to my life at Jofukuji, in this solitary place. I was practicing like a freshwater clam sucking in seawater, like a parrot attempting to put out a forest fire by soaking its wings and then flying through the trees. Like sprinkling a little drops on the forest fire to put it out. I had a vow and I believed I could not let it go unfulfilled. I believed that fulfilling this vow is nothing less than that of all the Buddhas. So that was one phase of his life. Oh yeah, so I hear a teaching from Kodo Suwaki to you. To me? To who? To you, who can't stop worrying about how others see you. Becoming Buddha means not looking around aimlessly. When you stop looking around, you can finally eat your meals in peace. Becoming Buddha means not looking around aimlessly. This is another zazen instruction. There's nothing other than this. But something else, isn't there? Practicing the way a Buddha means not looking around. It means being one with the present activity. It means samadhi. We don't eat in order to shit. We don't shit in order to make manure. But these days, everyone seems to believe that we go to school to prepare for university and go to university to get a profession. And so on. So, we don't sit in order to eventually become a Buddha. To arouse the mind of awakening, bodhicitta, means to stop looking around. Should I live as a monk? Should I give up living as a monk? Should I be a fishmonger? Should I sit sashin? Should I abandon sashin? Should I go here, there? Should I practice like this? When you stop this looking around and firmly decide to take upon yourself the heavy burden of the treasury of the true Dharma eye, and to be fully present wherever you are, that's arousing the mind of awakening. Dedicating this body to the way of Buddha, not looking around at all, means that the sublime, magnificent, and precious life completely reveals itself. Buddha is someone who doesn't look around. Oh boy. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.